can be determined from the definition that follows, that man is a social, imaginative animal. And we spent some time discussing what it means for him to be a social animal, and last time we were beginning to talk about what it means for him to be an imaginative animal, and I'm trying to give some illustrations and definitions of what's meant by imagination. Now, following the talk, I was asked if I could define or relate how the words revelation and intuition might fit into this various scheme that I've proposed, because this would therefore bear light on what I mean by imagination or by the mind kind of process that man has. And let me attempt to do this in this way. I believe that intuition is the ability of man to read sign language, and revelation is the ability of man to read symbolic language. Now let me explain the difference between these two. Let me give some examples. First, the example of an intuitive person who is using, I think this is sort of, these are powers of what I consider to be imagination in a way. I've noticed, and my wife was here, I think she leaves, she gets embarrassed when I talk about it, because usually I bring her up in one way or another in this discussion. But in some ways, she's a very intuitive person about my particular nature. And there are times when something irritates me, and I become very angry, but the social setting is such that I don't feel it very polite or appropriate to express my hostility at that time. And whenever this happens, for whatever the reason, if my wife is near me, she immediately senses that I'm mad at something, whether it's her or someone else or some situation. Maybe it's just a thought that I've been having about something that happened a year ago, and I'm thinking it over again. And suddenly she recognizes the fact that I'm hostile. And so far as I can tell, I haven't emitted any signs at all. But I have. And she finally determined what the one special sign is that tips her off to when I'm being hostile. And this has been documented to be true, and I'm going to talk about this in various emotions, that when our parasympathetic, or is it the sympathetic, I keep mixing these two divisions up, takes over, especially in strong emotional reactions, the pupils of our eyes are affected. They've done research to show that that when you are very pleased by what you see, your pupils dilate. When you look at a pretty picture, or a pretty girl, or something that's pleasing to your senses, a lot of people don't realize this, but your pupils in fact do dilate to an extent that they can be measured without complicating electronic measuring instruments, but just by very crude mechanical ones, the measurement can be made of an increased dilation of your pupil. Same amount of lighting. Now my pupils, when I become hostile, react differently. I'm not certain if it's the pupil or the eyelid, but she very definitely can notice this, that one becomes smaller than the other, that the area of my eye becomes smaller in one eye, my right eye, than in my left eye. And this is a large enough difference that my wife recognizes it. And she sensed my hostility before she could sit. I mean, for years she's been able to tell when I'm hostile or not. And she finally pinpointed it, that she's reading this particular sign. Now what I'm saying is this, that a sign is something that is not symbolic in many ways. See, it's sort of this just happens. My emotions take over and certain changes occur in my body, and my wife is sensitive to reading these signs. They're not really symbolic. You see, these signs in some ways are, but in other ways are not symbolic of my hostility. It's just an indication of my hostility. It's part of what happens when I'm hostile. It is not just symbolically, you know, my closing of my pupil is not really symbolic of hostility. It's a sign of my hostility. And I think an intuitive person is one who is able to read these signs in other people and in various kinds of signs about maybe a physical environment. They can sort of intuitively feel that this is a place they'll fit in because maybe the colors are mostly blue and green instead of red and orange. And there are effects that you see, that there are certain kinds of people that prefer red and orange to blue and green. You either fit in a blue and green person or you don't fit in a blue and green person. And these are sort of signs, not symbols. And I think an intuitive person is one who is very, very sensitive to these signs. Now, there may be a lot of problem with this definition, but it's all I've really been able to work out. Revelation is something different. I think there is a basic sense in that revelation occurs in those people who are able to be put into the in touch with the basic symbols used by mankind to communicate things that these symbols represent, but not directly, indirectly. That a person who is able to be in touch with revelation, or is able to, especially if we talk about the revelation of God to us, that what happens is we're able to recognize the symbols in maybe in our unconscious mind, but surely that are present in communication either between man and God or between human beings, among human beings. Let me give you some examples of this. The person who is able to read the book of Revelations, for instance, and understand what is being said here, is somehow very open to what these symbols usually stand for. And this is leading me to another, just very briefly, before I get into some of these symbolic means of communication that we are going to discuss today, beginning with Adam and Eve. Let me, and this is also a part of the same suggestion that was given me, explain very briefly part of a theory of a psychologist named Carl Jung, who was a disciple of Freud. In fact, the two had a very close alliance. Jung came from Switzerland to study under Freud. And Freud, the relationship between Freud and Jung was that of father and son. Freud really loved Jung, and he wanted Jung, Jung was a younger man than Freud. And Freud wanted Jung to take over the whole psychoanalytic movement when Freud died. But Jung began disagreeing with Freud. As you may have noticed, I've mentioned Freud quite often here. Freud's theory is that human beings are very sexual beings, that this is the main motivation he has, to fulfill the sensual, erotic nature of his body, to give him pleasure, rather than joy. You see, I think it was Leo Dusen, or someone, I don't remember, was talking about the difference between joy and pleasure. Was Freud's theory that a man is mostly selfish and dedicated to pleasure rather than even joy? Well, Carl Jung disagreed with many of these things, and he said that sex isn't so important for man or even his pleasure. What really is important is his sense of overcoming his feelings of inferiority, that there are other motives more important than sex. But that isn't what I want to talk about in his theory. What I want to talk about is his theory of the collective unconscious, which fits right into what I want to continue on saying. Jung believed, and he didn't quite know how this was possible. Now, genetically, it's been determined that it may be possible through the transmission of RNA molecule, or ribonucleic acid is a more scientific term, that when the child is in the womb there, and things happen to the mother, she has an increase of RNA molecules, which may be transmitted through the placenta to the child, and he may, in fact, learn things or acquire learning in this way. That's kind of another lecture in a might spend time on talking about experiments done with planaria, especially, and with rats in this area where they were. Well, let me just tell two very brief experiments, and then I'll continue talking about Jung, and then we'll lead into the stories, you know, the symbolic nature of man. One experiment with planaria was done where they trained planaria to run a teammate, and these experiments were done by different men, and with the same results. One was Mednick, another one was McConnell. And what they did is they trained these worms that after many, many trials, these very dumb animals, would learn that if they ran down the maze and turned right on the T, they would get a reward. But if they either stayed still or turned to the left, they'd get an electric shock, which they didn't like. So eventually, after hundreds of trials, a whole colony of planaria flatworms learned to crawl down this maze and turn right. You put them on the end of the maze, they crawl and turn right. Every time, no error. Then what they did, they cut these rats and these worms in half. And flatworms have this quality, they regenerate, so that each half, now they have twice as many worms that knew this maze. Then they cut these in half and the same thing, and then they did another sort of ingenious step. They ground them up, completely, just ground them up, and fed them to untrained planaria. And now all the untrained planaria went down the maze and turned right without having to learn. There's a transmission of knowledge here that has occurred. This is an experiment that has been replicated with the same result. Somehow a transmission of knowledge occurs between, you see, these flatworms who have learned and those who haven't learned. Now the untrained ones know something. Now what has happened is the question. And the theory is that there's a transference of ribonucleic acid particles from one to another. and that it's RNA that really influences learning. They've done the same kind of thing with rats then, where they take an extraction of RNA molecules from a rat that has been highly stimulated and trained and taught, and inject this RNA into an untrained rat, and they find that he doesn't automatically know the learning situation, whether it's running a teenage or whatever, but he learns it about 4 times faster than it took the first original group of rats to learn whatever it is they're trying to teach him. So there is some theory, I realize I'm sort of scrambling everything up I'm trying to say, but I'll try to make the point. Yeah. That Carl Jung's theory is this, that part of his theory, the part about the collective unconscious, goes like this. Within the nature of every man when he is born, there are certain unlearned behaviors that somehow the unconscious mind conveys to him, that, you know, things that he's learned. One of them is the taboo against insects. Every human being, when he's born, without being taught, as he grows up, realizes that he should not engage in incestual relationships within his family. Every tribe in the whole nature of the earth that has so far been discovered has this taboo against incest. Jung says the reason it's the same for everybody, he goes into this long theory that Freud even talks about in his book, Totem and Taboo, about how this came about, and we won't go into that, especially today at all, but it's the same for every human being. There are other behaviors that are sort of the same. We might ask the question, see, and it was John Locke a long time ago that said that when the infant is born, his mind is really a blank slate, tabula rasa. And psychologists now say this is just simply not true. When an infant is born, he knows a lot of things. He knows that he can suck either from a bottle or the mother's breast and it will give him food. This is an inborn behavior, whether we call it instinctual behavior or reflex behavior or what. It is something he does not have to be taught after birth. Somehow he knows this. And there are other behaviors that he does not have to be taught, that somehow are the same for all human beings. One is the Darwinian reflex, we call it. You touch the palms of a baby, and he will grasp whatever it is that's being touched. It's a reflex behavior, but apparently at one time aiding survival. And he could hang on, and this gives mother much more freedom to take him away from danger. It's the same thing with monkeys commonly do now. How was he taught this? You see, maybe it isn't taught. Maybe it's just a reflex behavior, but at least it works in the nature of these things, and sucking may be the same way. But how, then when we talk about these various behaviors among human beings, like the taboo against incest, Jung says what happened is this, that there is a racial memory in all human beings that way back our primitive ancestors, thousands or millions or however many years ago, scientists are finally going to discover man was on the face of the earth, that their behaviors and that their experiences gradually sort of were transmitted to their offspring, and these were transmitted to their offspring, and there are certain behaviors in our mind which we know, even symbols that we're put in touch with, and then he talks about dream interpretation. And we've started this last class, this is going to lead us now into the continuation of this last session we had, where Jung and Freud and the other psychologists of this mind say that there are symbols within the human mind of man that already have their symbolic reference in the outside world. That a bear usually stands for a father figure, a snake usually stands for a sexual symbol, a witch stands for a female figure, a mother figure, you see, especially having to do with this Oedipal complex, and on and on and on and on about this dream interpretation. That these symbols, now what I'm saying, you know, to make sense of all of what I said, revelation occurs in those people who are most able to be in touch with these kind of symbols. To understand that a bear maybe is a father figure, a wolf is a father figure. A person who somehow is able to have a greater capacity to understand his, what I sort of loosely call imagination, is one who, see, revelation works in this person who is able to understand this symbolic kind of language. Now, would anybody like to point out questions and difficulties? I sort of just kind of tried to work this out last night, and I realized there may be all kinds of immense difficulties in this problem. Maybe some of you would like to point these out to me. And then I'll either just say, well, I was wrong, and we'll try to work them out, and then I'll go on. You first, this girl.
Do you use this application of revelation for people like Jean Dixon? I heard that she uses snakes and so forth, their positioning and so forth, to make her prophecy. Would you describe this phenomenon under your definition?
Well, you're asking really the more basic question. Are those people who have this, assuming now, this is an assumption many psychologists don't find, I don't know if I do or not, that there may be this phenomenon of what we call ESP, extrasensory perception, which includes various kinds of things, clairvoyance and telepathy and psychokinesis, these various behaviors. assuming that these really do exist, and J.B. Ryan at Duke University is absolutely convinced on the basis of his statistical investigation that it does. And then we say, well, Jean Dixon is one who is not just a fake or lucky, but she really has this quality of clairvoyance. Now, this is extrasensory perception. Now, here's the question you're asking. Is extrasensory perception a certain kind of revelation? You see, the gift of prophecy, for instance. Well, I guess that without being able to really think about it, my first guess would be, yes, maybe this is a certain kind of revelation, but I think there's something more going on here, too. Maybe an extreme sensitivity either to her unconscious mind or maybe to God. I really don't know that much about her, but I think maybe this might fit in with the field of revelation, yes, that she would be one who is able to read the symbols of the universe, maybe, or get in touch with the collective unconscious, or maybe more directly, get in touch with the voice of God speaking to her through her unconscious mind, which is more the way I feel it personally. This is more the way I'd like to fit it into my own theoretical framing. I believe very definitely that God, when he speaks, does not speak to us, to our conscious mind directly, but at least very seldom, but much more commonly speaks to us through our unconscious mind through the use of symbols such as those included in the Book of Revelation or others.
That can that just as easily be interpreted under inspiration, though?
Well, see, yes, inspiration here would be the same, really, as being able to use this gift of revelation, I would think. See, that they're really saying much the same thing in my mind. I don't know what theologically the difference might be. But see, when I try to get these definitions cleared up so we somewhat know what I'm talking about, what I want to be able to do then is point to the common stories in our culture, and I think I went through a little bit of writing last time, and I want to point to Adam and Eve beginning this time period, and then go on to others and show that in fact, there are deep truths involved here that have to do with the man's power to understand symbols. You might call this revelation, you might call it, I don't know what else it could be called. I myself feel it's the power of man's imagination. And maybe I should be saying mine instead of imagination. Clearly, it's a definite working with symbols and signs of various kinds and men using them in different ways. And in ways very closely related to dream interpretation, in the very same way that Freud used it in his books, Interpretation of Dreams and Psychopathology of Everyday Life. And referred to in Totem and Taboo and Civilization as discontents these words. See, it's sort of fun. Now, let me have Paul respond first, because he's really the one that's stimulating this thing out of country. Well, I didn't know if I'd embarrass you that way, so
I'm not going to embarrass you. I was interested to hear you define intuition as, by the illustration, you define intuition as the rational mind applied to visible signs. In fact, that the signs to which the rational mind was applied were not necessarily visible to everyone.
If you're repeating what I said, I didn't take objection to that. I'm really not talking about a man's rational mind here when I'm talking about intuition. There is a quality at which, at least if it's rational, it's rational on the subconscious level, which then Freud at least would say is irrational. That a person doesn't really understand the reason for his saying what he does. For, a person that walks into a blue and green environment as opposed to a red and orange one sort of intuitively feel, but does not rationally understand, I fit in here.
Well, then my question only pertains to the example that you use. When your lovely wife sees your narrow pupils are a bit widened.
Well, difference in size. One of them is larger than the other. She'd really have to explain it to you. She explained it to me, and it's either the eyelid or the pupil of one eye becomes smaller than the pupil of the other eye, or the eyelid of the other eye. I'm not absolutely certain, but she senses it and knows now why.
She has learned by experience that certain things follow. You could call it, you might call it a Pavlovian reflex.
I think that this is really not I don't think quite the same thing. See, because I think this feeling of intuition, the way I'm trying to define it, would also occur in instances sometimes where there's been no previous experience. You see, and you really need experience for conditioning. But where something clicks that you recognize clicks, but not from the same experience. Pressed here for an example of a person who has this power of intuition, the kind of grasp of truth about the nature of something, even though he's never quite been exposed to the situation and able to do it.
May I offer an example?
Yes, please.
Used in this type of discussion. discussion. I'm sure that many of us, many of you have heard it. I know that Jerry has heard it. He just doesn't recall it at the moment. The story is that Einstein, in developing his formula for mass energy results, I'm sure I said that wrong. We were talking about the mass energy thing, that he had been puzzling over evidence or the signs that he had accumulated and never been able to determine a formula. And by the use of mathematics, he'd never been able to use a formula, a determined formula. And suddenly the formula appeared. It was intuitive to his mind. I can give you
You're equating insight now with intuition. And I guess there's
a very homely example that occurred in the psychology class to which I was a student many years ago, in which I participated many years ago. The one with the six matches, six wood stick matches, arranged them so that they will form four pyramids. And four identical. Oh, I gave that one away, didn't I? Four identical triangles. And I happened to be the one who did it. While I couldn't convince anyone else in the class, including the teacher, that I hadn't seen the instructor, that I hadn't seen it done before, or that I hadn't somehow had it back in my knowledge, but I didn't. I just stared at the matches and there was the answer. I do not remember any thought process whatsoever. It was just six matches.
Now this psychologically has been defined as insight, not as intuition. And I think insight here and intuition differ, at least maybe not in the examples I use, but in the way I'm trying to define it. And maybe there's a sense in which they are not different. I think they are. Insight is not really a reading of the signs, a sensitivity to the signs of something, you know, that there's something being said that you're able to pick up that others aren't, but that it's not necessarily a symbolic sign. It may be a very clearly representative sign, you know, that this thing really actually represents, you know, what it is without any symbolism being at stake, like a photograph represents a place. But I'm trying to say that intuition involves a real sensitivity on the part of people to pick up these kinds of signs somehow. And that insight is somewhat different in the way I feel it. It's different. I sort of intuitively feel that insight and intuition are not the same, but they may be. Maybe I should be talking about insight as the same as intuition. That's what you're doing here. And it may be very well that they are the same, though I somehow feel they are not. That there may be people who are not very sensitive, say, to the signs other people are emitting, who are very good at insight. I think that's true of many of our scientists, that they have a deep insight a lot of times into things, but yet they are not intuitive people in the way I like to think of intuition, as a real sensitivity to all the signs around, the signs of nature and the signs of people and the signs of... Now, it may be that I'm wrong, that these are just different degrees or different cases of insight. I don't know, and I guess I don't have the brains or anything to figure out right now this hour whether they might be the same or different. I sort of feel that they're different, but they may be the same, or different parts of the same thing. It's an interesting question, and I'd like to think about it all afternoon, but I somehow feel I can't think about it adequately now for some reason.
Thank you,
Jerry. He was really first. I mean, he's had his hand up for a long, long time, so.
I'm really going to let go on because it was way back.
Okay, so one of you up here then.
I was wondering if an example of intuition could be like in medicine, we often find that a mother will bring a child in who she says is sick, or I know personally, a mother who brought a child in and said the child had a deformity and the doctors couldn't find anything at that time.
Yes, that's what I mean by intuition.
But
maybe she's reading the signs in her child that no one else can read yet because they aren't sensitive enough to it. That's really what I mean by intuition. There are signs being emitted,
mm-hmm.
and this person's able to pick up these signals.
And you find it over and over again in mothers who it might be their first child.
That's why we commonly talk about a woman's intuition. I believe that a woman in this culture is conditioned more to be sensitive to her environment, much more sensitive than a man who instead is a rugged individualist and don't pay attention too much, but be aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
I think a woman really does have a lot more intuition than a man in the sense that she's using it, and that I like to use it, which may not, in a sense, differ from the insight you're talking about either. I just don't know.
Could it be that the mother or wife is more concerned with keeping her family well and happy and working in this area more than the father?
But it doesn't have to, I don't believe, be just evident in family relationships. It may be, for instance, that a woman... And I think I've known situations like this, where a woman will walk into a room and all of a sudden she looks around and she's never seen anybody in that room before, and she says to herself, "No, I like that person, but I hate that person." And for absolutely, you know, a man that had asked her why, she could not for the life of her say why. I just feel it. That woman over there I like, but that one over there I hate. She's catty and gossipy and she's and somehow she'll be right. You know, and a man just, oh, here, I do have an example now. A very good example, I think, of what I mean by intuition. A man was about to make a very large investment with a business acquaintance. And the business acquaintance came over to the house. And they were talking business, and the wife pulled her husband aside and said, "Don't you make that investment. You know, don't have anything to do with this." And the husband says, "Why? Look at rationally here, everything works out." "I don't care," she said, "about reason. Just don't make it. You know, I know something's the matter with this." And sure enough, it turned out later that this business partner with whom the husband had been through, this is supposed to be a true story. I read it instead of hearing it, but it was written as a true story. You know how these things are, though. May or may not be true. But I think it makes a point of intuition. That this woman, though she couldn't explain it at all, had felt that this man was concealing facts somehow, or there was something wrong with his character, and therefore went to business with him. And the man later on was arrested for his shady business transactions, and had the husband made the investment, they would have lost much money to the, you know, which this other man would have appropriated for things that he hadn't told his husband. Yet the wife felt it. She was reading signs about him that the husband couldn't read. She was more intuitive, I think. Yes.
But this kind of subtle and definite reactions to character, without exactly much information, is not limited to women.
Oh, no.
Aren't we all operating?
But I have a feeling that the person who is more able to be sensitive like this also has more of what I'm calling intuition. That he reacts more intuitively to a situation than he does rationally. See, there's something very rational, I think, in a sense, about insight, that once you get the problem, you can explain. Well, maybe I can't explain quite how it came to me, but I can explain at least, you know, that this is the answer and show that it is. And there's something that can be rationally explained about this answer. See, that if you stand the sticks up like this, it makes more sides per the amount of sticks or something. You sort of sense that there might be a difference here? Maybe there isn't. But I sort of feel that there may be, because I know that an intuitive person very commonly just cannot come up with any explanation of the reason why he or she feels that way.
Can justify the even the conclusion as being the correct conclusion.
That's right.
The math is very easy to justify.
Though it may just be that intuition is approaching the insight, that if a person more closely understood the signs that he or she were reading, for instance, was reading, that then it could be more rational. I just don't know. My own intuition kind of tells me there's a difference here, but I just don't know. It may be that I'm wrong and that these are exactly the same thing, only different shades of the same thing. Yes, one more.
Maybe the difference lies in the amount of information that you have to look at. The term insight is used as insight therapy. You know, when you have a lot of information given to you. You just let a patient ramble. Mm-hmm. And then you attempt to make some sense, helping see into his feelings. Mm-hmm. He's still giving you quite a bit of information to look at. Mm-hmm. You have verbal symbols and thoughts to look at. And you can attempt to rearrange them and make some order and find some new
So then again, as you mentioned, this incident leads me to a confusion then between what I'm trying to describe as insight and as intuition and as revelation. Because this leads very closely to revelation. There comes a sense at which these signs become symbols. I can think of one very definite example that so impressed an instructor I had at the University of Minnesota, Paul Neal. He said that that one of his friends was working in therapy with a woman who all of a sudden startled and said, "There's a book upside down on your bookshelf. It's standing on its head instead of straight up." And though the conversation had been, he'd been working completely on a certain kind of a problem, and all of a sudden he had what I guess I'd have to call a revelation then, because this is a symbol, not a direct sign. He had this revelation, "My gosh," he thought to himself, and there was other evidence here that was very, very faint. "This woman has had an abortion." Just from that little tiny, you know, her all of a sudden interest in this book standing on its head. And the way he worked this out, and there was a little bit more information that had been given, and then he worked on the problem. The problem this woman had was guilt concerning this abortion she had. The main thing that tipped him off was this book standing on its head, and also the fact that he knew that babies are usually born head first or upside down, it started his whole train of thought in a different line. Though there was additional information that I haven't given you about other things that she'd done that sort of would make one leave, you know, feel guilt reactions and maybe have something to do with her. But this is what tipped him off. Now, would this be revelation or intuition? See, there's a sense at which they approach each other. Is this a sign or a symbol? I think it's a symbol, but many of the other things that we talked about as signs might be also symbols.
Well, I think it would be reason, this time.
Eventually you was able to reason it out, but we can do this with revelation. See, what I'm about to do now, and I'll do it, I think, probably in the next minute, is to start talking now about what I consider to be valid forms of revelation that can be psychologically reasoned out. And I think the story of Adam and Eve gives us a kind of revelation like this, where we allow ourselves to get in touch with the symbols that speak to us through our unconscious mind. I believe these symbols to be, if we understand them correctly, and I may have a misunderstanding, what I want to do is have time for discussion of this with some of the theologians present to set me straight whether the psychological interpretation fits with theology or not. But I believe there is a very definite sense in which there is a psychological revelation about the truth of the nature of man given to us through the story of Adam and Eve, as through many, many other stories. And we'll go through some of these other stories, I guess not tomorrow, that's 4th of July, isn't it? But Friday. The story of Adam and Eve, let me just sort of briefly summarize the essential parts of it for you and then explain the symbols used here, at least the way I understand these symbols. And I haven't heard other people do this in the same way, but you see, so you can pick on me alone and not feel that I'm an authority here saying this. But the way I understand the story is like this. First, the symbol. There's the Garden of Eden, a fruit-bearing tree. Notice that it's not an apple tree. If it were an apple tree, this would symbolize something different, I think, but it's a fruit-bearing tree. I could go into the difference. An apple tree symbolizes something very definite, I think, and so does a fruit-bearing tree, especially a fruit-bearing tree that bears the fruit of knowledge, especially the knowledge of good and evil. These are very definite symbols. They get right down to a certain specific subject matter in dream interpretation. There's a snake. And I guess that the only other real important subject matter here are Adam and Eve. These are the main characters in the story, right? Now let me tell you the story a little bit the way it goes in the Bible. In the beginning, man was created by God, set in the Garden of Eden, and he was alone. He recognizes the aloneness. He had dominion over the world, and he had everything he wanted. But he recognized that he was alone, and he asked God if he couldn't have a helpmate. And God said yes, and created woman. He created woman from Adam's rib. He took one of Adam's ribs out and breathed on it, and it became woman while Adam was in a deep sleep. Adam and Eve then lived together in the Garden of Eden, and were told you can enjoy everything you want except for this one thing. Don't eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But a snake came to Eve, said, you really should eat from this tree, you know, if you really want yourself to be better. In other words, this is a selfish motivation that he's giving her. If you want to better yourself in a way that's in opposition to God, you eat of this tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and you'll become like God. You'll have much more knowledge. You'll have much more, you'll be God like yourself. You'll be the creator in the center of the world instead of God. You'll be the ultimate good. So Eve eats of this fruit and shares it with Adam. And after they do this, they realize that all this time they've been naked. And so they clothe themselves, they're ashamed of themselves, and they clothe themselves with fig leaves. And then God comes, and that's essentially the story. Oh, and then they're expelled from the Garden of Eden. There's an angel with a flaming sword that guards the entrance to the Garden of Eden so that they might not return, even though their desire is that they might return. This is a punishment, a banishment. Now they must toil for their food. They must suffer pain in childbirth. They must die. Many of these things happen because they've been expelled from the Garden of Eden. Now, anyone like to correct me? Is that the essential story? Have I left any essential parts out or mixed it up? Isn't that essentially the way the story goes? That's the way I see it. Now let me tell you what I'm going to do as a psychologist. Not as a theologian, but as a psychologist. I'm going to look at this story as though it were a dream. As though the symbols of the story are ones that come from within the unconscious mind of man in a kind of revelation of truth. And interpret these symbols in exactly the same way that Freud has interpreted the symbols of dreams that he reports. See? Do you understand the methodology here? You may disagree with the methodology. I'm not asking whether you agree with it, I'm just asking whether you understand it. This is a dream now. Now there are certain principles in dream interpretation that must be followed. I'm only going to talk about two of them because you'll notice here that this is one objection that you might otherwise raise. In dream interpretation, we need not take a story, it's the chronology of a story, the time sequence of a story, we don't have to interpret it in exactly the same time sequence that it occurs. Time sequence in dream interpretation just means that these things are related. It does not necessarily mean that one thing happens before another. That's just a very definite principle of dream interpretation that Freud has well established in interpreting dreams for psychologists. Another factor is this, that one symbol may have more than one meaning. This is what we call the principle of condensation. Now, these are the only two principles that should cause any trouble, I think, and if you understand this, but I'm doing this as a psychologist, not as a theologian. I think we can arrive at a certain truth together, at least a thesis upon which we may disagree. Here's an interpretation. The essential beginning of the story starts like this, that in the beginning, God created, and this is a very essential part here, in the beginning. What does this refer to? Again, as a psychologist, I think there may be many, many, many meanings. It may mean lots of things, but I think it means this. At the beginning of our individual lives, in other words, at conception, this is what I take to mean in the beginning. This has some support, but let's just not, I want to get through this yet until we can discuss it. In the beginning means in the beginning of our individual life. And the essential part of the story goes like this, that in the beginning we were in the Garden of Eden. Now what is the Garden of Eden? It's a place where everything is warm and comfortable, where we don't have to toil for our food, it comes to us automatically, where we're surrounded by the presence of God who has not only given us life, but sustains it for us, who is an encompassing good. And what else has the Garden of Eden? It's an aquatic environment. There are four rivers that flow from or into, I forget now. I think it's from the Garden of Eden. Notice this, that there are four rivers. This mention of an aquatic kind of an environment surrounded by and flowing into it. There's lots of water or fluid. Now the psychological interpretation is this. The Garden of Eden is the womb in which man grows at conception. Notice something else about this. And I left this part out unintentionally. That when man is created, he is created in the image and likeness of God, and he is very good at his creation. Lately, we've been talking about the doctrine of original sin. It isn't in the Bible, but it's been interpreted this way, that when man is created, he is without original sin. He experiences his presence of God, and he is very good. Psychologists show us this. Now, see, the Garden of Eden is a symbol for the womb. In the beginning refers to the conception of an individual human being. When a man is conceived, he is in this environment where he doesn't need to toil for his food. It's hard work for a newborn child, we call it a neonate, for a neonate to suck for his food after he's born. But now he gets his food automatically, it's supplied from his mother. When an infant is born, he is cold, but now he's warm and comfortable. When an infant's born, he has to do lots of work even to breathe his air, but now this is given for him. It's a very comfortable environment. And I think this is a symbol that the Garden of Eden is the womb. The aquatic environment, we know now about the amniotic fluid that surrounds the neonate. We know that, and I think this is a symbol here of rivers, especially because Freud has said, and he's, I think, really a master, he may be an atheist now, but I think he's a master at understanding revelation. It's the understanding of the symbolic nature of man. Freud has pointed out and well substantiated that rivers, almost always in dream interpretation, refer either to a, not only rivers, but all kinds of water. They may refer to something out of which man is born. This is a symbol again in baptism. A man is immersed into the water that he may be reborn out of the water. This is the way the original church did it. Because there's something about the nature of this symbolism of water. In many, many dreams, when a man emerges from an ocean onto an island, it's a symbol of his birth or rebirth. Water also has, very commonly, especially if it's a river or a channel of fluid, refers to that part of the anatomy which in a female is connected to the reproductive process, the entrance to the womb. And it's very well substantiated in the literature of dream interpretation. So what I'm saying is this then. The story says this, in the beginning man was living in the Garden of Eden or in the womb where everything is given him, where there is no frustration really, where the presence of God is symbolized, the presence of God means psychologically the presence of mother. At which he's united with mother. He's at union with her. She's a source of love for him. She's the one that sustains his life. That mother, in a real sense, takes the place of God for that child before he's born. She is the revelation of God to him by sustaining his life in this way. Then what happens, and now this is out of chronology in the story, but I already explained that. It's not important. Man is expelled from the Garden of Eden. This is the birth process. Otto Rank, a very famous psychologist, has said that birth trauma, the trauma of being born, or the frustration of being born, is that which already is the prototype, or what Jung would call the archetype, of man, all of man's problems and neuroses and frustrations later. What happens here is that he's separated from his source of strength and his source of love. In the biblical story, man is separated from God. He now is alone, rather than at union with God. This newborn child is separated from his mother, and there's a real sense of isolation and aloneness and no longer having the presence of God. What else is there about it? Oh, let me tell you a little bit more about Otto Rank's theory. It's been repudiated by psychologists, but now they're coming back to it in a different way. They're saying that if a human being never experienced frustration, he would always be good and kind and loving. Freud put it this way, that the energy, which he later called sexual energy, but originally speaks of as libidinal energy, that this energy within man is really to serve what he calls the life instinct, that desire in man to maintain his own life, self-preservation, but also to preserve the life of everyone around him. The main function of this instinct is reproduction, to give life to the species, preserve the entire life of the species. But it's a good instinct and a healthy one originally. It is only really concerned with construction, building up, preserving life, with love. You see, which Freud says then is culminated in heterosexual relationships, which we engage in marriage. But it's a good thing. Freud said, and I know a lot of people disagree with Freud, but I think he's right here, that it's frustration that turns the life instinct into its opposite, the death instinct. He calls the life instinct eros, the death instinct thanatos. That when a man becomes frustrated, some of this libidinal energy or this life-giving energy is changed into its exact opposite, and he strikes out to destroy rather than to build up, to hurt instead of to help. I think he has a real insight here. Now, how does it fit into the story of Adam and Eve? Birth is the frustration. The expulsion from the Garden of Eden, from the presence of God, is so frustrating that it turns man's basically good nature at creation into a basically sinful nature at birth. So that at birth, man is sinful and unclean in the state of original sin. Not at conception, but at birth, because of the frustrating nature of the separation from mother. This is what is symbolic, I think, of original sin. And psychologists know this is true. That at birth, we don't know much about the nature of man at conception, but at birth we know darn well that he is sinful and unclean. And by unclean, I don't mean just that he's not able to control his, we won't get into that. But that there is a basic sense at which at birth, and psychologists use these terms, he's narcissistic. And you know about the myth of Narcissus, what this means. It means that he's so much in love with himself, he doesn't have any time or energy left over for anything else, even to eat. that was Narcissus. He fell into the pond and drowned. That he is egocentric, that he is the center of his universe. God is not. The attraction for goodness doesn't really concern him. It's the attraction for his own pleasures. He's egocentric. That's what Piaget calls him. Freud calls him narcissistic. Other psychologists come right out and say that he's self-centered. He's selfish. And that's true. An infant that is not warm and dry and well-fed If it's 2 o'clock in the morning and his parents are sound asleep enjoying, you see, the luxury of sleep, the infant will cry and scream and kick till one of them gets up and feeds him and takes care of his needs. He doesn't care about them, he cares about himself. He is selfish. And this is well documented, that an infant is not what mothers like to think of him, an angel from heaven, an innocent child. He is a selfish creature, very self-centered. Subjective thought much more important than objective thought than him.
Skinner wrote a book about baby blocks, about how one of his own children can control the fire. Where the temperature, the air, everything else is just perfect. And then, do you know what the result of that was?
Yeah, he had two children, two girls. He may have had more than that. I know of two of them. The first girl he reared in an air crib. For the first few years of her life, really, that was essentially her environment, the air crib. That's what he called the Skinner box, is an air crib for humans. She grew up and went to Radcliffe and graduated and married and now has children, and she does not rear her children in an air crib. She's very bright, and she's just like all very bright people. A lot of people think she's neurotic. A lot of people think she's very well adjusted and happy, but she's very bright. You know, she's a creative woman, and she has trouble adjusting to some personalities. Others, she gets along with very fine. Skinner had another daughter who was not reared in an air crib. She grew up, I don't remember where she went to school, but she's also bright, and she is now rearing her children in their crib the first few years of their life. No, I don't know what to name that. The one who was reared in an air crib will not use it. The one who was not reared in an air crib does use it.
I guess what I wanted to ask was, did this affect her basic self-centered?
Well, who knows? You know, I don't know. I mean, Skinner himself was quite enamored of this procedure, though his second daughter, he did not do the same thing to it. It's very difficult to tell. I think you'd almost have to talk to Skinner and the daughters to really form your own opinion. The literature on this, you know, is mostly supplied by Skinner, and, you know, it's pretty hard to tell really what happened. Let me just I want to finish up this interpretation of Adam and Eve, I guess, and I do want to answer these questions. I think they're very important, but I also don't want to be left without time so that I can finish this interpretation now that I've started it. And so maybe what I'll just do is finish the interpretation, and then we'll discuss all these things. Just jot down your questions, and we'll come back to it. And I really, you know, that's the thrill of this, is to be able to discuss these things. But I sort of feel I'd like now to finish this, and there's still quite a bit left in this interpretation of the story. So the basic part, one essential part of the story, I think, psychologically, is this, that the symbolism of the Garden of Eden is really the symbolism of the womb, that in the beginning refers to the beginning of human life rather than just the creation of the world, symbolically, psychologically, whatever it may mean, theologically. Expulsion from the Garden of Eden is the birth process. And there's something about the birth process that when you witness a birth, you might see how this is so. That there's a very trauma of being expelled from the Garden of Eden. What happens in a newborn baby and a baby about to be born in the birth process is this. That the opening, the birth canal, is so narrow that as he goes through the birth canal, his head is squished. He has six what we call fontanelles, soft spots, openings, expansion plates on his head. And the birth canal is so narrow that the head is squished. The fontanelles actually, you know, allow the portions of the skull to squeeze together in sort of the shape of a dunce cap or a raindrop. And this must be traumatic for the baby to be squished this way, and he then is passed through the birth canal. When he is born, the gates to the Garden of Eden, if we're talking about, you see, the opening of the birth canal being now the gates to the Garden of Eden, are in fact guarded by fiery flaming swords, in a sense. There's a real sense that this is so. There's an outpouring of blood that both precedes and follows the birth, which I think is, this may seem very far out to you, that this inflammation of this tissue, you see, we talk about it as inflammation, a fiery red, right? And the blood also. I think that this is symbolic, really, of the angel standing there with these swords. Never let the infant back. After he's born, not only have the openings closed up again, you know, quite closed, and this inflammation of his tissue, but another thing happens. His head begins to grow together. These fontanelles close up, so his head will forever now be too large to allow him to go back up through the birth canal. He never again can re-enter the womb. And many psychologists say this is a desire that stays with man forever, to again enter the Garden of Eden. To again re-enter the womb. I'm going to talk, that's what the rest of the story is about. Man's desire to re-enter the womb in various ways. One way that psychologists have said, and Paul, you may be aware of this, I understand that in California there's been a large booming trend in the building industry to design homes rationally on the basis of making them a womb-like environment. That bomb shelter, now psychologists have suggested this, I don't know, this is the part of the story I may not agree with, I do agree with the other part. That they say that man has such a desire to live in a womb that many buildings are being built cave-like, without windows, a very secure kind of thing, in the shape of bomb shelters, or the form of bomb shelters, and that they're selling it, that people feel so secure in this. Is that sort of true?
Well, it's a typical California dream.
Well, the answer to that one. But psychologists have to hold it.
Not up in the redwood.
But this is a psychological kind of a theory. Now, there's another theory about man's desire to re-enter the womb. And this is the rest of the interpretation of the story of the Garden of Eden, giving a revelation about the basic motivations of man, in my personal opinion. And I believe some of these, you know, as much as others of you may disagree. And this involves really the nature of a sexual relationship. Now, why would it? Let me explain first the reason why I say this before I explain the story. It is my belief, and we talked about this when we talked about the social nature of man, that man at birth does feel isolated, that he does feel alone and lonely, and that he needs a relationship of intimacy with someone else, with his God or with another human being. That the most fulfilling way that man knows on this earth to experience this intimacy or sense of non-separateness is through the intimacy involved in male-female relationships at marriage. That this can be the most fulfilling relationship of non-separateness that a human being can experience. And 2 weeks ago, and I maybe should have done that to kind of make my point a little better, I read a prayer of St. Teresa, which spoke, it was a prayer to God, and it was a love poem, an erotic love poem, where just one of the verses goes like this. He refers to Christ, dealt me love's sweet wound, and with the joyful pain thereof, I swooned. And then she talks about lying, and the rest of the poem is the same imagery. That her relationship to Christ, to her God, this mystic saint, was expressed most beautifully in her mind through the imagery of sex. Because this somehow humanly helps us bridge the distance between people. That there's something about the nature of intimate physical contact that doesn't make a man feel so separate anymore, both from other human beings and from God. And this is why sex is such an important motivation. Many of the symbols and stories refer to sex. Because man has this, I think, basically this conflict that only sex really resolves. And it's this conflict. Am I going to be alone and separate, or am I going to experience a relationship, a non-separateness? And I think that there are only two behaviors in the history of man that can express this dilemma most appropriately, where he can either be completely unselfish or completely selfish by the same activity. That is killing and sex. He can kill someone as Abraham was about to kill his beloved son Isaac as something to do for an ultimate good, the will of God, and this becomes non-selfish. Or he can murder someone for his own purely selfish interest, regardless where this may be, whether it might be in an unjust war, or it might be just a murder of someone to take his property. That killing can either be completely unselfish or completely selfish. And in the same way, a nature of a sexual relationship can be completely selfish, the violation of another human being for your own sensual pleasure, or it may be completely unselfish, a relationship of altruistic love. And this is the problem man has in this world. Is he going to be selfish, or is he going to be unselfish? Is he going to relate to other people, or is he going to use his own erotic, sensual parts of his body in a completely selfish, egocentric way? This is the dilemma we face. And the way a man faces this problem of sexuality is the way he faces his relationship with God and with all of the problems in life. If he is unselfish and communicates love unselfishly, an attraction for good, a communication of good, this is the way his entire life is lived, and it's also a sexual relationship. But if he takes the Hugh Hefner playboy philosophy that he's the center of the world, and he violates other people and uses them as objects for his own pleasure, that's a different story. Now, what did Adam and Eve do in this story? Let's go back to the story and interpret it. And what does it say about the nature of man? Here's the way let's interpret this part of the story now. Remember that Adam and Eve are naked. They don't have any clothes on, and they're not ashamed of it at this time. But a snake comes to Eve and says, have a fruit from this fruit-bearing tree which bears the fruit of knowledge of good and evil. Now, what can we interpret about this so far before we even get into Adam? Snakes, historically, in dream interpretation, and I think there's good documentation here that this is a an adequate way to translate the symbol of a snake, has been translated as a phallic symbol, as a symbol of sexuality. Notice what happens here. This symbol of sexuality tempts Eve, while she's without clothes, to eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Now, what is this fruit-bearing tree, bearing the fruit of knowledge of good and evil? How is it interpreted? Well, it's quite simple, really, I think, and maybe you already see the interpretation here. In the Bible, woman has been referred to as the fruit-bearing tree, the nature of woman. She's admonished to be fruitful and multiply. If she's fruitful, this isn't good. There is something about the nature, and Freud has noticed this in other dreams, that the symbol of a fruit-bearing tree refers to a fertile woman. Especially this is true when it's a tree that's bearing not just an apple, which has different connotations, and we can talk about that but more today, but bears the fruit of knowledge, especially the knowledge of good and evil. The word knowledge in the Bible very commonly refers to sexual knowledge. When the Virgin Mary tells the archangel that she cannot possibly have a son because she hasn't known man, biblical scholars tell me the same word here, know. The same root word, it's the same both in the Adam and Eve story and in the story. If I haven't known man or had knowledge of man, and she's referring to sex here. If I haven't known man, I can't have a child. And it's the same word used in the Adam and Eve story, this word of knowledge. And it's knowledge of good and evil. There's something about the nature of sex that may either be good in a relationship of love or evil, self-centeredness, like Hugh Hefner talks about it. And I think that there's very little question among psychologists, if they really think about this, that one of the interpretations of this story here is this, then. That Eve is tempted to have sex with Adam, to share the fruit of this fruit-bearing tree, which is herself, the symbol of herself, with Adam. But this is done not... Oh, darn it, I've got about 5 more minutes here. We should be in. I suppose we could continue this tomorrow. I really have to just quickly skip over this because then it misses, I think, you know, so many questions can be raised. Well, let me just quickly try it and we'll come back to this tomorrow. That what she does then is that she selfishly, against the will of God, this has been forbidden, which I think is the symbol meaning here that she's doing this selfishly for her physical joy rather than a communication of love. She seduces Adam. And Adam and Eve have intercourse together. And suddenly, after this experience of the sharing of this fruit of sex, they both feel ashamed and they clothe themselves. Now, this has been known, there are many, many stories. We're going to talk more about the story of Cinderella. This is called, in fact, the Cinderella syndrome. That if you have sex with someone and you don't love that person, you do it for selfish reasons, you feel ashamed and you run away. We'll get into that tomorrow. Now, there's still more to the story than this, though. And let's take that for tomorrow, because it's sort of a... It's this. Notice that the blame for sex here, for all the evils that follow, is placed on Eve. She is the one who seduced Adam. Now, what does this mean? And it's the same thing in the story of Pandora's box. Pandora is the one that opens this box, and Freud says the same box symbolism is the same symbolism of the womb. Pandora opens the box, and she's a female, and she's responsible for the evils that follow. Now, why is this so? And we'll talk about that psychologically tomorrow, and then I'll answer questions and we'll talk about the whole story. But there's just that one more segment left of this story that for interpretation, and then we'll talk about the nature of original sin, and we'll go into this theologically, and the theologians can pose questions that I'm sure I haven't answered. But at least it'll provide us with a basis of discussion. It won't be tomorrow's report, it'll be on Friday. And then we can go into other of these myths, which I think contain a real revelation of the nature of man, if they're correctly understood. And maybe I'm incorrectly understanding them. I think that if I'm wrong theologically, it's because I don't understand them correctly, they must be reinterpreted. But that the nature of man is there in these stories.